Good afternoon. You are listening to Answering the Call, brought to you by listener-supported Light of Life Radio. I'm your host, Derek Rader. Today on the program, we will hear from our guest, Deacon Joe Prentice of Morgantown, West Virginia, as he shares with us the unique story of how he came to answer Christ's call to the vocation of the permanent diaconate. Deacon Joe, we are blessed to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me for this interview. I am in the process this week of celebrating my 35th anniversary of ordination to the diaconate. Bishop Joseph Hodges ordained me together with seven other classmates on June the 16th, 1983 in Wheeling, West Virginia. And it's been a very interesting full life ever since that time. But what I should do is kind of reminisce and wondering whether God called me early or late to be a deacon. It all goes back to my childhood. I was born April the 13th in 1928 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I grew up in the ambience of a large Redemptorist parish. Redemptorists are members of the Congregation of Most Holy Redeemer, established by St. Alphonsus Liguori. And during that time, my middle-class family and I had a wonderful time being members of that parish, but at the same time, we suffered a lot of hardships because my father lost his job, and therefore we no longer had the means to support ourselves well. But the one thing we did have was the backup of this wonderful church, where, by the way, a Redemptorist bishop was buried named John Neumann. And today he is called St. John Neumann, as it is usually pronounced. When I grew up in that parish, I also went to the local Catholic school, which was a blessing because those of us who were very poor during that Depression era, still got an excellent Catholic education. When I was 10 years old, in the fourth grade, Sister Celestia once said, "Joseph, you and two other boys are being asked to go over to church and become altar boys." I wasn't given a lot of choice. I think I was chosen because I was proficient in language. And therefore, the first thing we had to do as altar boys was to learn to recite Latin prayers of the old standard Latin Mass. I found it fascinating, exciting, and I enjoyed the company of the priests and brothers who staffed that large, wonderful, big parish. A couple of years after that, when I was 12, I was able to become a Boy Scout in the Boy Scout troop that was established in that parish. And that, too, gave me a sense of fulfillment because I could do Catholic things and get, for example, an award, Ad Altare Dei, which was given to Catholic Boy Scouts who served at Mass. And at the same time, I find myself full of activities that took me away from the crowded, humble city. When I was 14, the Redemptorists asked me if I would be willing to go to study to be a priest. And here at age 14, I felt there was a call. I admired the Redemptorists for being great preachers. They used to give retreats. They would fill parish churches with great speakers. And these people would roar about sin and the necessary evils that had to be overcome in the world. But when they got the penitents into the confessionals of following the strictures of St. Alphonsus, they would be humble and quiet as lambs. Lions in the pulpit, lambs in the confessional. And I found this fascinating. Along the way, by the way, I had a sister, an older sister, who imitated the little flower, St. Teresa of Lisieux, of devotion that was extremely common in those days. When she was 16 years old, she went off to take the Carmelite habit in a group of women, a new congregation that was established to care for poor, wretched people who lived on the streets. And they would take them into the beautiful homes which were donated to them. My sister would go out on the streets every day with another nun, and they would beg. They would beg for funds among people, mostly in New York City, where she worked a lot. They would take this home and then use it to support the poor people. Eventually, my sister became a nurse because she thought that many of those people had ailments and they needed help. So she went off to a Catholic hospital, became a great nurse. And like so many good people, she died fairly young. After she died, the Monsignor who assisted her said she was a real saint, and it was touching. This is the sort of atmosphere that I had. I had three brothers and this sister, and it was a good family, happy atmosphere. Both my parents, by the way, were strongly devoted to the Blessed Mother, and that was partly due to the influence of good St. Peter's Church, because the great devotion in that church, among the Redemptorists especially, was to Our Mother of Perpetual Help. There were weekly novenas. Many, many prayers. People came from all over the city to the weekly novenas in that parish. This was an inspiration for me to go off to a monastery, a seminary, and study to be a priest in that fashion. When I went off to distant northeast Pennsylvania, which was a suburb of Erie, I found it was difficult because, like me, there were a bunch of young men who were recruited from all over the eastern seaboard, and we all spoke funny. I had a thick Philadelphia accent. I said things like, "Don't walk too fast." And that was part of what I was criticized for. But the kids from New Jersey, from Pittsburgh, from Baltimore, from especially Boston, who would say things like, "Don't forget the pack your cod, hop and yod." We all laughed at one another. And the irony was, we were all told by our excellent instructors that we should all emulate the great Midwest accent, none of us had that particular accent. Anyhow, it was an interesting scramble for 75 young men in my entrance class to get together and start learning Latin, which was a big stumbling block. And the irony is this. In those days, there were seven men in our group who had been left behind from the previous year. They had studied for a whole year, and they could not master Latin, so therefore they were left back and put into our class. And in our class, a new people, we had some who were excellent at mathematics and science, but could not conform well to Latin, and they had a hard time. To put it simply, after 6 years, by the way, we weren't in a high school. We were in a college. We were in a six-year preparatory college. And by the time we finished in our sixth year, with a little bit of attrition, year after year, there were only 25 of us left. So from the first 75 to 25, and that's considered, I suppose, a normal kind of attrition. Those first couple of years, by the way, were difficult because they were wartime years, Second World War, and we got to go home only for 1 month in the summertime. To be away for 11 months, starting at age 14, for the first time, fills a person with a great deal of homesickness. After one semester, one vacation at home, and starting the second year, we felt a lot less homesickness, but it was still there. By the time we finished 6 years, we really yearned to stay there. We had made such fine, fast friendships that that was the place to live, rather than my humble Philadelphia home. At any rate, after 6 years, we transferred to the next transitional place, the novitiate of the Redemptorists, which at that time was located at Ilchester, Maryland, a distant suburb of Baltimore. And there we went through a rigorous transformation. We learned to be prayerful all day long. We learned to give up a lot of our preferences and tastes. We even put aside a lot of our studies. We no longer studied diligently, but rather we spent our time meditating and praying, getting up at 5 a.m., putting on a Redemptorist habit, which we wore night and day, and doing all those useful things that tend to make a person pious, humble, happy, fruitful. And it was a wonderful life. It was a complete transformation for me, especially because I had grown up in a rough and tumble fashion. I had been a vigorous Boy Scout. I had done many things on my own that were, I suppose, very selfishly oriented, even though we had had 6 years of good grooming at Northeast in our preparatory 6 years. But I found my life was completely transformed. After 14 months or so, we finished that novitiate experience. We came out of the cocoon, so to speak. We took vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and we felt like full-fledged Redemptorists going out to kind of conquer the world, to preach missions, to save souls for the world, to follow St. Alphonsus, who had set up his congregation of the Most Holy Redeemer with the notion of saving the most abandoned souls. He was very serious about that.
You are listening to Answering the Call, brought to you by listener-supported Light of Life Radio.
And then, of course, along the way, I learned a lot about St. Alphonsus, a man to be emulated. He was born in 1696 in Naples, Italy, from a very wealthy family, a noble family, and he was extremely well-educated. He not only was a lawyer in civil and canon law, but he was clever. He was a musician. He during his lifetime, he composed great hymns, both in Latin and Italian, which still are sung, especially at Christmas time. The little hymns like "Tu scendi dalle cieli," "You, your baby Jesus, come down from heaven," or things like "Jesu le amo te, quia tu amas me," "Oh little Jesus, I love you because you love me." This is the kind of hymns we sang, of course, especially in the novitiate. And one interesting thing about that novitiate was that we celebrated Christmas every month, the 25th of every month. The Christmas was very, very special. And we had this wonderful feeling that came from St. Alphonsus. Now, I emphasize that because later in my life, Christmas will have a very special significance. Well, after we went on to the new major seminary, I found it a tremendous change. The major seminary was a magnificent place. It had been built on a large hill overlooking the Hudson River. And across the river, we could see the estates of the Roosevelts in Hyde Park and many other great mansions. We were located somewhere between Poughkeepsie and Kingston, New York, in a place called Esopus, a marvelous, wonderful life. As a matter of fact, life there was so good that I felt kind of upset because I had gotten used to the life of mortification, the life of abnegation, the life of giving up one's selfishness during that long novitiate. And that had stuck with me. I had felt that this was a wonderful new way to live, and when, in effect, I got out of that and went to the new life in the major seminary and was given new freedom, a large individual room for the first time in my life, and many other benefits and perks. We were given beer occasionally for big holidays, and even some wine. This had never been thought of in my earlier formative years. But they were good times. I made wonderful new friends in that major seminary, and life treated me well. And within 3 years after my coming there, I could have been ordained a deacon. So if I say, why do I now reminisce as to how and why God called me to a deacon, to be a deacon, I would say, well, at age 14, I was given the opportunity to become a priest, and I followed it zealously, sedulously, diligently. I was extremely happy with the thought. I admired all the Redemptorist priests who had inspired me along the way, and I was moving steadily toward that. At age 25, I would be ordained a deacon. But now the big question here is, why was it until I was 55 that I was ordained a deacon rather than 25? There's a 30-year gap, and I suppose that should be the crunch of what I have to discuss here. Why 30 years? Why, after 2 wonderful years of studying philosophy at St. Alphonsus Seminary along the Hudson River, did I falter and not pursue it? Here I follow the Redemptorist order, the Redemptorist regime, diligently. I followed my vows of poverty, chastity, obedience, seriously. I took all of them serious. Many people would say, well, if you leave the seminary, you had an urge immediately to go out and get married. And certainly that was far from any of my thoughts. My major thought was, why am I not as holy now as I felt I was back during my great novitiate? To make a long story short, after 2 fruitful years of great studies, I decided that I was enjoying myself too much, and it was not proper for me just to enjoy the life there without feeling that any fulfillment. I no longer had that great urge to move forward and become a Redemptorist missionary. As a matter of fact, my thoughts were vague. I went step by step, day by day, doing my routine and enjoying it, but not seeing any vision anymore. And I felt because of that, I was selfish if I stayed. I had great friends. I had no other place to go. Life was wonderful there, but I didn't feel as though I was following God's will. And in a kind of a dark night of the soul, I decided to leave and see what God had in store for me elsewhere. I had to be released from my vows. It took a while for that to be given, but my vows had been only 3-year temporary vows. And it happened, and I went off, and I left the greatest life I knew, and for the next 10 years or so, I would be homesick for the wonderful people and place that I knew at Mount St. Alphonsus. However, I did go forth, and when I came home to my original home in Philadelphia, my parents, my relatives, were all perplexed. They could not see why I suddenly, after all that effort, had left. And I felt perplexed. I felt empty. I wandered around, and once when I visited adoration at a church in downtown Philadelphia, I passed a Navy recruiting office. And they said, here in the height of the Korean War, we're looking for naval aviators. And I signed up. I suddenly felt I had to do something with my life and make it an independent thought, an independent choice. So I did so. I was sent off after the Navy accepted me as a candidate. I was sent off to Naval Aviation Cadet School training in Pensacola, Florida. And I spent 6 months there. It was a good life. We were well treated. The discipline was easy. It was a lot easier than what I had experienced in my seminary years. But the big problem was I didn't have any great zeal about what I was doing. I was doing that which was useful. I was very patriotic, and I had wonderful associates, all of whom were fine gentlemen. But at the same time, I developed sickness. And maybe that was due to my lack of commitment, I am not sure. But every time I flew and we went through serious maneuvers, the stress on my stomach would cause my food to regurgitate. And every time I flew, I would have little bags of material that I puked up that I would have to hide somewhere in the flap top pockets of my overalls. And I got away with that for a long time. But eventually I felt I was endangering others when I was practicing landing and takeoffs and landing and takes off. And I wasn't as careful as I should have been because of my sickness. So therefore, I left that program. And I was sent to work aboard an aircraft carrier for about the next year and a half of my tenure for my 2-year commitment in the Navy, which I enjoyed very much. I enjoyed working with other humble swabbies, as we were called, on the aircraft carrier decks. It was a little bit dangerous, but it's still very interesting work. After that time, I went home to Philadelphia, got a 1-year appointment. I studied 1 year at LaSalle College. That was required for me to get a degree because actually all the education I had had since age 14 was unaccredited. There was absolutely no credit given to any of it. LaSalle College took pity on me, and after spending 1 year there, they then gave me accreditation. Shortly thereafter, I was recruited by the Office of Naval Intelligence. They had sent people to LaSalle College. I was an outstanding prospect, according to their norms, especially because of my Navy background. And I was recruited to be a special agent for the Office of Naval Intelligence. So I spent a couple of years working in the Philadelphia office. I spent 3 years working in the Pittsburgh Office of Naval Intelligence. And during that time, I applied to be transferred to Naples, Italy. At the same time, I met my wife, Ilana. We were married. I had a kid brother who also went into the seminary long after me, and he performed his first wedding for my wife and me just before we shipped off to Naples, Italy. Well, we spent a wonderful time there. I enjoyed being in the home turf of St. Alphonse Liguori, whom I admired so very much. After a year there, approximately 1 year, my wife was pregnant. We were expecting our first child, and she desperately wanted to return home to the United States in order to have the baby. And I didn't, I was disappointed. I was enjoying the broad experience I had working in Europe. I worked all throughout the Mediterranean Sea. I worked on ships. I worked in different countries. I used different languages. It was an exhilarating experience, but she wanted to come home. She felt she would get better care in the United States, so we came home. And I was then transferred to Cleveland, Ohio, While there on Christmas Day, she gave birth to our firstborn son. And when Randy was born, it was a wonderful experience because of my recollections of how wonderful Christmas had always been in the past for me. However, disaster seemed to strike. Within 2 weeks, the day before he was to be baptized, he was to be baptized on a Sunday in January. That particular Saturday, my wife went across the road to get some provisions for the celebration we would have when friends and others came to join us for the baptism. But she left a healthy, wonderful baby boy in the crib as she went out. Within a half hour of her leaving, a maid came to our apartment to offer me some fresh towels. And then she looked at the baby and she said, "Sir, your baby isn't breathing." A half hour before, this healthy baby had been touched by my wife. I grabbed the baby, rushed to the sink, and I baptized him. And I now think back to all the many babies I have baptized since then and wondering if that was kind of a sign, a symptom of things to come. When we rushed the baby to the hospital, he was declared dead. And that put a tremendous crunch in our life. At any rate, we had other children, one of whom was a baby boy who was severely retarded. After living in Cleveland for 3 years, I decided to leave Naval Intelligence Service. That was after 9 full years. And we went back to Pittsburgh, her hometown, and I got a master's degree from the University of Pittsburgh. And then I was recruited to work as an investment banker. I worked for a large firm in Pittsburgh, stayed there for about a year and a half, a little longer perhaps, and we decided then to seek additional help for our retarded son. So we had Blaze and Bart, the retarded boy, and our daughter, Brenda. We took all three of them with us. We packed up and moved to California. We were told that somewhere in the San Francisco Bay Area, we could get help for our retarded boy. When we got there, we found out that there was a lot of confusion. There were specialists there who would perhaps specialize in the kind of unique sickness that Bart had, but the waiting list to get to see them was immensely long. We were quite disappointed.
You are listening to Answering the Call, brought to you by listener-supported Light of Life Radio.
By the way, the first day we got there, I got another job. I got a job working in the finance quarters of downtown San Francisco for a firm that specialized in selling tax-exempt municipal bonds. So, with that job in tow, we looked for a place to rent. And one finds that it was almost as bad in those days, that was in the 1960s, almost as bad then as it is today, where rents are astronomically high. And they are even higher a little bit south of San Francisco toward San Jose in the so-called Silicon Valley area. But back when we were there, Silicon Valley was just a thought in somebody's mind. The people who, for example, developed Apple computers were just beginning to function. And therefore, the rents there were a lot less than San Francisco. So we had a wonderful time renting in San Mateo. And I was on the edge of Silicon Valley in those days. With the work I was doing in selling tax-exempt bonds, doing it fairly successfully, I was able to pry a kind of an opening into what then became Silicon Valley, near Stanford University. And if I had stayed there and worked with that, I could have been there today living, let's say, in the lap of financial luxury among millionaires who scattered all over the place in that area. But there were two drawbacks. The first drawback was the salesmen whom I worked with and among, both in that San Francisco office and especially in the main office in Beverly Hills, were people whose scrupulosity was something that left a lot to be desired. They were not very honest people, I'm sorry to say, and I'm glad I have not given the name of the firm I worked with in order to betray that. And also, it was even worse, maybe, to deal with the clients. The people whom I sold bonds to were often good lawyers and doctors, but again, some of them were so full of greed, some of the other people especially, that I found it difficult to try to convince these people to buy the product that I was selling. So in a fit of, I suppose, disgust, I resigned my position there, wrote a letter to a humble professor who had been my guide at the University of Pittsburgh, where I got my master's degree, which I worked on, by the way, mostly on the side when I was a young single man in Pittsburgh, and told him I was thinking of giving up that particular life and perhaps becoming a professor. It was something people had often predicted for me, that because of my interest in studies, I should be a professor. And I had decided earlier on, well, I'll make a lot of money first. And I know professors don't make a lot of money, but I'll first accumulate wealth, and then I'll be able to work as a professor. Here I was doing just the opposite. I had nothing. I had not accumulated a lot of savings because of all the moving around that we did. I wrote to this professor, asked him about openings, and he told me of two openings in the field of classics, which was what I was suited for. One was at the University of West Virginia, WVU. So, in my spare time at lunch, I went over to a branch office of the post office in San Francisco and scribbled a note to this address he had given me, to the Department of Foreign Languages, and sent it off, saying something to the effect, I have a master's degree in classics. I'm interested in changing my profession, becoming a teacher. What do you think of my prospects? Imagine sending off something like that. And I add as a footnote that since I spent 31 years after that as a full-fledged professor in academia, I have never, ever seen as scrimpy and modest a proposal for a job in my whole life. When we looked at prospects, at requests for new positions during my years of being on search committees, we would see the most elaborate folders given all kinds of background. All I did in that simple scribbled note was to say, I'm interested, I have this degree from Pitt, what are the prospects? Within 3 days there in San Francisco, I got an answer, a beautifully typewritten answer from Dr. Bob Stilwell at West Virginia University. And he said, when you come east, if you're going to do that, look me up. And I figured, boy, and I point out at this time that all during my life, maybe I haven't immediately responded to God's call to be a deacon, or whatever he was calling me to. But along the way, step by step, I was nurtured and I was assisted by God in everything I did. As I look back, I see his touch in every move. Here I did the unlikely thing of writing a simple note for a job, and I got it. Well, one reason I got that job, by the way, I found out when I finally did come east, I took the chance. We just packed up and left, and I came right here to Morgantown. I had never been in West Virginia before. I knew a lot about it because I lived in nearby Pittsburgh. But when I met Bob Stillwell, I realized why he was not impressed, not unimpressed, with my particular note. He was blind. He didn't see the note. His wonderful wife, Alma, had read it to him, and he liked the way I expressed myself, and he said, come see me. As they say, I've never heard otherwise of anybody applying for a job like that. And if that wasn't God's particular touch, I don't know. Because it brought me to West Virginia. It gave me a chance to meet wonderful, godly people, and eventually to become a deacon here in this wonderful state. Well, Bob Stillwell did hire me, but the dean said, you must commute to the University of Pittsburgh and get yourself a PhD. So when I was hired, we had three children, so three surviving children, after having lost the first. And then during the time we were here, we had two more. And all during that time, I was also giving a very hard teaching load. So 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I had this large teaching load. Tuesday and Thursday, did I say Monday, Wednesday, Friday was the big load. Tuesday and Thursday, I commuted to the University of Pittsburgh. And I took courses galore, graduate courses. I wrote a PhD. And all of that was finished within 4 years. But they were four tumultuous years of raising a family, of having very little income, and of having a tremendous burden because I not only taught languages, I was teaching when I first started courses in French and German and Latin and Greek, and then I was also the assistant director of the large humanities program where we handled hundreds of students in big courses. So that kept me extremely busy, and yet they were happy years. And I think the happiest time occurred way back when in St. Teresa's Church. We attended that in order to get a cheaper tuition for our children at school. In those days, that was the only resource because they controlled the school. One of the assistant pastors said, they're looking for new deacon candidates in West Virginia who would like to apply. And I know he had at least three people whom he was targeting because of activities of theirs at the church. I was not very active. I was busy with all the things I've already suggested. And yet after that mass, with one of my babies in my arm, I said to him, you know, Father Dorsch, I think I'd like to apply. He looked at me puzzled. He had never noticed I was active in the church. However, I did apply, and I suddenly felt fulfilled. I felt that when I had thought of becoming a deacon and a priest early on in my life, and it had not panned out, and I had left the seminary with an empty feeling, that emptiness was still somewhat with me. And suddenly I felt this must be God's fulfillment to fill in that empty slot and call me to be a deacon. My good wife, Ilana, put up with it. And I say put up with it because one of the things I brought with me here was a little card that was given to wives at the time of our ordination, prayer to St. Lawrence, where wives are told that they should humbly assist their husbands. The prayer starts off something like, Lord, I said yes when my husband was ordained a deacon. This yes meant my support, my love, by sharing him as he serves our brothers and sisters. Thank you for our marriage and our life together, and so forth. This is a very difficult thing for wives.
You are listening to Answering the Call, brought to you by listener-supported Light of Life Radio.
I ended up in a wonderful group of classmates, and the husbands and wives were all fine people. We had about a dozen, I'd say over a dozen applicants at the time. But eventually, after 4 long years of slogging and studying and working and sharing and praying together, after 4 years, only 8 of us were ordained. And of that 8, 2 of them were converts, 2 of the wives were converts, and we had a lot of other uncertainty with regard to the people, which I won't go into, except to mention one little facet, and that is, here I was with a PhD in a class where at that particular time, there were no strict academic requirements. I had a PhD, my colleague Oz Schultz had a similar degree where he taught in early childhood education, and we also had George Needham, who was with us from Morgantown, all 3 of us among the 8, and George had a master's degree, and he was a coordinator for the Coliseum and other facilities at West Virginia University. Well, the man who became my best friend from Wheeling was Paul Smith, who had only a degree from high school. Paul felt overshadowed by us, and he felt as though he could not compete. At any rate, he was the best scholar in the class. He tried so hard to make up for it that he spent all his spare time studying and doing wonderful things. I'll make this funny little aside. Jordan Edith eventually got an annulment from his marriage. And on the strength of that, he was recruited to become a priest. George was sent to Rome to study at a small seminary. When he got there, they asked him about his background. He said, well, I'm a deacon. They said, give us a list of your studies. He wrote back to our formation area, and they had no record of the studies we had done. They had been kind of piecemeal studies. They needed somebody to teach the course. They had a nun do it. Somebody else was a brother. Somebody else was a priest. They just plugged in little gaps and gave us 4 years of studies, but nobody kept any consistent record. George Needham could not prove what he had done. I said to his former wife, I said, there is one person who could help, and that is Paul Smith. Paul Smith, in his wonderful studies, this humble man who had only the degree from high school, kept meticulous records for every course and every project that we worked on. So I had her call Paul. Paul sent a complete record of all the things we had done together. And that helped Jordanita to become a priest. Today he's a retired priest living in his native Parkersburg. So it's been a long, interesting haul. And I will repeat this, that I felt that when I was 55 years old and I was ordained a deacon, it might have been 30 years a little bit late, because I could have been ordained a deacon when I was 25. But along the way, it was worthwhile. Along the way, I've learned to be truly humble, I think, truly to appreciate the lives and efforts of so many good people whom I've known in Morgantown and throughout the entire state. I've worked throughout the entire state of West Virginia. My summer times have been spent in various places, including all the major parts of West Virginia where I've done surveys. And I've met awfully fine people. And among the deacons whom I worked with at that time, there were great people. There were a couple of classes of deacons who had preceded us, and there have been classes who have followed us. Each format is different. When I first was ordained, our class had no particular assignments. When we were ordained, they shook our hand and said, well, now go home and work with your pastor. And depending upon how much the pastor wished us to work with him was how much work we did. We, of course, were ordained to do things like preach, to serve communion services, to work in hospitals, to work in nursing homes, to work in so many places. But there were lots of things I didn't anticipate in this particular role. Well, I found that every pastor I worked with, and I worked with over 40 priests since I've been here in Morgantown, every pastor or associate pastor had a different influence on me and had different suggestions for the ministry I do. I will say that in general, the major ministry that I have fulfilled in this area has been in charge of baptisms, and I've prepared people for baptism, and I've done many baptisms. But I've done the whole gamut. I've done weddings, and I've done a lot of preaching, and I visited sick and homes and such. But the big surprise, I would say, that overcame me was having worked so much with non-Catholics. I've often preached at Protestant churches. I've been very friendly with Protestants. I've been very friendly with Jewish rabbis, and I visited with them and prayed with them. And I've been at the synagogue, and I've been asked to explain why Christians are so grumpy and other things to Jews. It's been a fulfilling, long experience, and there have been many, many surprises. I might say the first surprise that came to me when I was a new deacon was when I decided to transfer to St. John University Parish, because I felt my affiliation with the university would be better fulfilled. And I did that. And then I met Paulists. Some people might not know how and why Paulists were formed, but they were formed about 150 years ago in New York City, established by about four dissident Redemptorist priests. They were converts, and they said to the Redemptorists, there are too many of you people like Bishop John Newman who are working primarily with the foreign people. Newman goes all over Pennsylvania and Maryland and New York, and he works among foreign people. Why don't we work primarily baptizing people in the United States and also evangelizing Protestants? That was the format, the charism that the Paulists wished to establish. They were told, we don't do that, and you're disobedient. Stop being disobedient. Disobedient Isaac Hecker and a couple of other Redemptorist priests went to Rome, petitioned the Pope, and the Pope allowed them to leave the Redemptorists and establish a new congregation, the Congregation of St. Paul. So hence we get Paulists. So when I worked among the Paulists for a good many years, we always thought it was kind of a joke that I had the same kind of background as they had, because they too came from the Redemptorists. They were, in a sense, former sons of St. Alphonsus, and so was I. But it was a good experience working with the Paulists. Should I maybe summarize the wonderful time I've had as a deacon? It's so very difficult to summarize it, because there have been bumps along the way. There have been a lot of bumps. I think the chief of which would be that as a result of the Second Vatican Council, the permanent diaconate was established something which had been abandoned over 1,000 years before. The church had suppressed permanent deacons, and now it was reestablished in the places like Dachau during the Second World War, when priests gathered in large numbers and said, we better do something better in the future. And they suggested the permanent diaconate, and it was finally established after the Second Vatican Council. About 51 years ago, the permanent diaconate was reestablished. At any rate, it's been a long road, but one of the difficulties of the Second Vatican Council is the so-called spirit of Vatican II. The spirit of Vatican II has been a disruptive feature. And I say spirit in quotation marks, because so many people who wish to be dissident Catholics today merely misinterpret or interpret the spirit of Vatican II any way they want. And I think that's caused a lot of confusion and a lot of hardships, because some of the people who instructed us in our deacon formation program were Spirit of Vatican II liberals. And that caused difficulty. It caused some of the deaconate candidates to be either fawningly in agreement with them or to hide their true convictions and say, I can be a conservative Catholic again once I'm ordained. So maybe that's a sad note to leave it on. I don't wish to leave it on a sad note. There are so many wonderful deacon friends that I'm thinking about that I could maybe commemorate. I could reminisce forever. It's been a long, hard road, a long, easy road. I'm sorry about the word hard. I remember speaking to one of the Benedictine priests whom we've had here in recent years, Father John Paul. And I said to Father John Paul one day when I went to confession, I said, you know, it's really been too easy. It's been too easy a journey this far, and I expected it to be much harder. But I do believe that the blessings of being a deacon have made it so easy and so fruitful.
It really is inspiring. And in that light, I'd like to ask if there's any advice you could give to anyone at any stage of their life who may be listening when it comes to discerning their vocation, perhaps to the diaconate.
Well, those who discern vocation to be deacons, I suppose primarily should realize that deacons become fruitful if they are living happily in a good marriage. And I have seen some deacons whose marriages were shaky, rather deacon candidates, and they did not make good prospects, because it's important, as I suggested before, that a husband and wife go into it full-fledged. And some wives, like my wife, make great sacrifices. Be willing as a deacon prospect to love your wife with a great intensity, to ask her all along the way whether she will pray with you to see whether you have a potential vocation. Now, I'm talking about deacon candidates as aspiring to a vocation. It's possible, of course, that men who are younger will aspire to the priesthood first, and that's certainly to be encouraged. We have a lack of priests today. I think partly because of that lopsided idea of the spirit of Vatican II, where people have decided against following old-fashioned norms. The best old-fashioned norm is to pray diligently. And let me add a note that I should have added in my comments before. One reason why I so much enjoyed being a Redemptorist and appreciated coming from a Redemptorist background was because of the Redemptorist's great devotion to the Blessed Mother. St. Alphonsus Liguori was a tremendous, tremendous advocate for prayer and devotion to the Blessed Mother. he wrote countless books, such as The Glories of Mary, which is one of the great books, in which he gathered together praises and comments on Mary that go way back. Mary has been a very important part of my life. And let me add that St. Alphonsus has said at almost every prayer he writes, he has a little coda saying, "Let us remember our Mother Mary." At the end of every prayer, Mary is there. And he also said, devotion to Mary is a sign of predestination. He tells stories about people who were kind of reckless and carefree in life, but often said a Hail Mary before going to bed. Stories about how they got a visit from Mary just before they died. Devotion to Mary is so great that anyone who prays fervently to Mary on a regular basis will find an answer to his or her vocation. Now, in my particular case, the answer came, as I say, belatedly. God really wanted me, I am sure, to marry the wonderful woman I did and to have the wonderful children that we've had, despite turmoil, difficulty, despite having the first baby die, the first baby born on Christmas Day, despite having our third son severely retarded, and he had died after living some 50 years. But despite it all, as I said to Father John Paul Heiser, it's been too easy. It's been wonderful, partly because of Mary. Mary makes it easy if she's always at your side.
Would you like to give a blessing to our listeners?
I certainly would. Let us all thank God for the blessings he has given us, and let us remember that on a daily basis, we should say this prayer. God, I thank you for all your goodness, kindness, make me happy, and I ask personally that God will bless all of you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Thank you, Deacon Joe Prentice, and thank you to all our listeners who have tuned in for the program. Answering the Call is a production of Light of Life Radio Ministry. For more information or to hear more great programming on demand, visit www.lolradio.org. www.lolradio.org.